on that. Anti-racist education that anti-racist books serve in a protective fashion, particularly for white youth when they are exposed to white supremacy, because through learning about the history of white supremacy, they are better able to recognize it. Several of Candy's books have been banned or targeted for removal from school curricula and libraries, including the National Book Award-winning Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. Texas Senator Ted Cruz drove Candy's children's book Anti-Racist Baby onto bestseller list after denouncing it and several other books during the Senate confirmation hearings of African-American Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. Professor Candy continued, anti-racist education, first and foremost, is teaching children about the history of white supremacist ideology, the role that white supremacist ideology played in racial slavery, in settler colonialism, in Jim Crow. It's teaching children U.S. racial reality so that they can see that, though Americans look different, though Americans maybe speak differently. They are all equals, but the cause of these inequities are indeed racism. The domestic terrorist in this case reportedly chose Buffalo after searching zip codes close to his overwhelmingly white hometown of Conklin, New York. He then traveled several hours to Buffalo's Kingsley neighborhood and targeted the Tops Friendly Market on Jefferson Avenue. Why the supermarket? India Walton, a former Buffalo mayoral candidate and senior strategic organizer with the progressive organization Roots Action, explained on Democracy Now! We know that 80% of the population of the east side of Buffalo are people of color, are black people specifically, and they have one place to shop. We have dubbed it food apartheid because it is a policy decision. The fact that there is no food on the east side of Buffalo and there is not the availability of these basic services is a policy choice. There are people who actively chose to not provide services in this community. For a long time, we've been told that this Tops on Jefferson, we are lucky to have it because no one else wants to come into the neighborhood. The Buffalo mass murderer also considered additional targets, either a church or a school. According to online chats attributed to him, he feared the school would have too much security. Fortunately, he was stopped at the supermarket. White supremacists are making the case that it's the people of color, that they're the source of their pain, which is something that many of these young white male supremacists are being indoctrinated on, groomed on, and thereby carrying out mass shootings. Ibram X. Kendi said, adding, "This is only going to get worse if we don't get a handle on it." Limiting access to guns and expanding access to education about the role of racism in the U.S. society and learning, as Ibram X. Kendi's book title suggests, how to be an anti-racist are fundamental steps to stem the horror of hate and heal these long festering wounds.
The Congo, treasure island in the heart of Africa.
Part 1.
On August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its east rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. On June the 30th, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. In the ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa. Rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond, and in most cases there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. He had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes. So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence seeking among millions of the Congolese people. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo, which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office, a decision that the prime minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu.
Joseph Mobutu.
Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history. Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the U.N. session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the U.N. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then U.N. Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu. the Prime Minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off. Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government. Patrice Lumumba delivered speeches to the people in most of the cities and villages in his escape to the north to inform them about the facts behind the developments in the Congo. CIA agents followed Lumumba all throughout the way. They were looking for a suitable place where the coup army could arrest him. On December the 1st, 1960, as the Prime Minister was crossing the Sankuru River with his family, the spies announced that the time was ripe for his arrest. As Lumumba's boat approached the shore, forces loyal to the coup leader Mobutu got into the boat. Lumumba was taken to the capital aboard a plane, but those who accompanied him forgot that he was the Prime Minister until just a few days ago. Patrice Lumumba arrived at the airport of Leopold, which was full of reporters. They showed the Prime Minister to the public in a very humiliating and offensive way, a move which was planned to tarnish his charismatic image. His wife and children were witnesses to what was happening at the airport some meters away. Lumumba, along with two of his cabinet ministers, Maurice Ampolo and Joseph Okito, were sent to the state of Katanga to be executed. Moise Tshombe, Lumumba's archenemy, was looking forward to receiving his guest. On June 17, 1961, the Katanga government, led by Moise Tshombe and supported by Belgian advisors, decided that Patrice Lumumba and his two accompanying ministers should be executed. At around 8:30 p.m., the prisoners were taken to a place in the depth of a remote forest to be executed. Moise Tshombe was present in the place along with his ministers. The soldiers shot Lumumba and his companions dead and then rolled their bodies into a ditch. The coup government spread a rumor in an attempt to answer to the public opinion. The rumor was that Lumumba had escaped in a stolen car and was later arrested and killed by local people. However, the people of the Congo never believed this official account of the incident. The true story about the abduction and execution of Lumumba was leaked after several years. But Lumumba's body could also be highly problematic. He was so popular that the discovery of his body could put his murderers into trouble. Therefore, they decided to exhume and destroy the bodies. The mission was delegated to a Belgian officer called Gerard Sote. They returned to the place where the bodies had been buried. They exhumed the bodies, and after drinking a lot of alcohol, they dismembered the bodies and dissolved them in sulfuric acid. After years of conflict and civil war, Joseph Mobutu wrested full control over the Congo in 1965. After that, Mobutu, who called himself Mobutu Sese Seko, ruled over the Congo for 32 years with an iron fist. He even changed the name of the Congo to Zaire. With Mobutu's seizing of power, the U.S. had found a puppet government in the heart of the strategic continent of Africa for three decades.
Well, Zaire is among America's oldest friends, and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends, the entire continent of Africa. And we are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you, sir.
Mobutu was one of the world's wealthiest men until 1997, with a fortune estimated as much as $5 billion, while the Congo's population of 40 million had been degraded to one of the world's poorest nations. Mobutu was ousted from power in 1997 by Laurent Kabila, a leader of one of the main rebel groups. He later died of cancer in Morocco. During the civil wars that ensued Mobutu's fall, some 5.5 million of the Congolese people were killed, while millions of others were displaced. Nine African countries and 20 militia groups were involved in the wars, which are remembered as the African World War. Civil war, violence, disease, hunger, and poverty were the legacy of the colonialist rule of Belgian King Leopold II, as well as the involvement of the White House rulers in overthrowing the only democratically elected and popular government in this green land. Although in 2002, the Belgian government apologized to the Congolese people for the involvement of its forces in deposing and killing Patrice Lumumba, the U.S. government has yet to apologize for architecting and launching the Congo coup and contributing to Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime military has intensified its attacks in Jenin in recent weeks. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Tamara Nassar, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Jenin Fiercely Resists Zionist Regime's Constant Attacks. Here's the story. A Palestinian teenager was killed by the Zionist regime troops in Jenin recently. Palestinian health authorities identified him as Amjad Walid Al-Fayed, 17 years old. The Palestinian resistance group, Islamic Jihad, said their member was killed in an exchange of fire between Palestinian resistance fighters and the Zionist regime occupation forces during an Israeli invasion of the northern West Bank city. Hundreds of people turned out for Al-Fayed's funeral. The Zionist regime occupation forces killed a 17-year-old Palestinian boy during a military raid into the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. A second teen was seriously injured when the Zionist regime forces shot him in the stomach. Islamic Jihad said Al-Fayed was related to two Palestinian resistance fighters who fought against the Zionist regime troops during their invasion of Jenin in April 2002. In April 2002, the Zionist regime's military massacred at least 52 Palestinians and injured scores of others in Jenin refugee camp, according to a report by the United Nations Secretary General at the time. The Zionist regime forces also shelled 150 buildings, leaving 450 families homeless. According to the report, 23 Zionist regime troops were dead by the end of the operation. Last week, the Zionist regime forces used a Palestinian teenage girl as a human shield during a firefight with Palestinian resistance fighters in Jenin. The Zionist regime's military besieged the house of Ahad Mohammad Reza Mereb in Jenin's Al-Hadaf neighborhood at 6 a.m. on May 13th in order to arrest her 20-year-old brother. After ordering Ahad's parents and younger brothers out of the house, the Zionist regime's army opened fire at the house where her brother remained. Her brother retaliated by shooting at Israeli regime troops, according to a field investigation by Defense for Children International Palestine. 2 hours later, Palestinian resistance troops began firing heavily at an Israeli regime military vehicle. The troops forced Ahed to stand outside the military vehicle for 2 hours while they sat inside exchanging fire with Palestinian resistance troops. Bullets were being fired at the military vehicle from all directions, Ahed told DCIP. I was trembling and crying and shouting to the troops to remove me because the bullets were passing over my head, Ahed added. But one of them ordered me in Arabic through a small window in the military vehicle, stay where you are and don't move. You are a terrorist. Stand in your place until you say goodbye to your brother. Ahad tried to tilt her head to the side to dodge the bullets, but one of the Israeli troops ordered her to stand up straight, the CIP stated. She was forced to remain there for 2 hours before running near a tree and collapsing. She was treated at the hospital for severe mental distress and low oxygen levels. After evacuating a house where she lived with her extended family, including 8 children, the Zionist regime troops bombed the house with rocket-propelled grenades, causing it to catch fire, and then attacked it with live ammunition. In recent weeks, the Zionist regime military has intensified its attacks in Jenin as resistance in its refugee camp has grown more defiant. The Zionist regime forces invaded Jenin refugee camp and the nearby town of Berkin on May 13th, as it has been doing on a nearly daily basis, wounding more than a dozen Palestinians and making arrests. One Israeli regime officer was killed in Berkin that day. The Zionist regime forces sought to arrest Palestinian Mahmoud al-Dubai. The Zionist regime troops surrounded his home and ordered him to surrender himself. Following an hours-long exchange of fire between al-Dubai and the Zionist regime occupation forces, which reportedly included Israeli forces firing Energa anti-tank rifle grenades at his house, al-Dubai was arrested. The amount of gunfire aimed at us was indescribable, thousands of bullets. An unnamed senior officer was quoted as saying by Arutz Sheva, a publication supporting Israeli regime settlement activities in the West Bank, adding, "I have been in the army for more than 20 years and I have never seen anything like that." In an effort to find new ways to thwart resistance, the fabricated regime of Israel is considering a return to the use of air raids against the camp, a method of repression the West Bank has not seen since the Second Intifada 2 decades ago. Helicopters and drones may be used to secure ground troops through the use of deterrent fire and possibly shoot at armed combatants, the Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz reported. Meanwhile, the brother of one of 6 Palestinians who last September escaped from one of the Zionist regime's most fortified prisons has died after being shot by the Zionist regime occupation forces in Jenin. During the fighting in Jenin on May 13th, the Zionist regime troops shot Daoud Zobeidi. He was a brother of Zakaria Zobeidi, the most well-known prisoner who escaped in September. Zakaria Zobeidi is a former commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, a Fatah-affiliated group. The wound was transferred to the Rambam Hospital in Haifa, where he died on May 15th. The far-right Israeli regime politician Itamar Ben-Gvir visited that hospital shortly before Dawood Zobeidi's death was announced. Ben-Gvir called for Dawood Zobeidi to be executed. The killing of Dawood Zobeidi brings to 228 the number of Palestinians who have died while in the Zionist regime detention. The fabricated regime of Israel is still withholding his body and refusing to hand it over to his family. The Palestinian Prisoners Club said the Zionist regime forces fired at him with the aim of liquidating him. The brother of another escaped prisoner died in fighting with the Zionist regime forces last month. Shams Kamamij, 29, was killed in Kafrdan village on April 14th when the Zionist regime forces opened fire at a crowd of people throwing stones at military vehicles. He was the brother of Ayham, another one of the escapees from Gilboa prison, the escape was viewed as a devastating blow to the reputation of the fabricated regime of Israel and its so-called security apparatus. The prisoners remained at large for days and in some cases weeks before being rearrested.
Tümen. Yani...
Bazaar.
The need for home appliances dates back to the early stages of human existence, when cave dwellers began developing tools to preserve and prepare food. Today, home technology has become more sophisticated to match our fast-paced lifestyles. The level of convenience and comfort of home is also determined by these items, and they have even become a status symbol for some. In a sense, home appliances define modern living, changing the means of dealing with food, clothing, cleaning, and so much more.
Hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm Samson Seas, back from the Seven Seas. It's great to be back. This week, we're going to dive into the world of home appliance production. We want to see who the major players are in this industry and see how the market is doing. We will also uncover some of the major contributions of the home appliance industry to the country's economy as a whole. So, let's check it out.
Our journey this time took us to Abbasabad Industrial City on the outskirts of the capital Tehran. There, we visited a company that specializes in the production of home appliances. Emerson was established some 40 years ago and has become a household name in this industry. In the early days of its activity, it started out by making freezers. Over the years, it has expanded its product list and now manufactures refrigerators, cookers, and washing machines, among a long list of other items. This company has expansive production halls, which house its chain production machinery. Each production hall is tasked with a certain process of manufacturing, such as preparing material for assembling. From start to finish, everything happens at the production lines. Having an assembly line in the manufacturing process helps keep production processes regimented. This ensures the uniform production of items. It might be interesting to know that this company uses the latest computer-assisted robotic equipment in its production halls to get the job done. Automating processes help guarantee that each step is performed with uniform standards throughout. The other advantage is it allows quality control checks and implementation of standards to be performed with speed and accuracy. An integral part of this company is its research and development department. It is strategically intertwined with the production space. Products here are randomly pulled and tested at different stages. But that's not all. This advanced department also collaborates with foreign companies in research. Its production lines produce hundreds of home appliances each day. With this in mind, it has also provided hundreds of job opportunities. The company employs expert technical engineers and experienced workers to manage designs and machines. This company has a unique outlook toward the future and is continuously looking for more ways to foster growth opportunities. As part of its future vision, it hopes to expand its reach and gain a larger share in the international market by increasing its product portfolio. Like many in the manufacturing business, the US sanctions have caused some challenges for this company. But this firm was able to turn these challenges into major opportunities for growth. As you might know, local home appliance brands in this sector also compete with foreign ones. Iranian manufacturers produce the same quality of home appliances as their international competitors, yet many in the country still seem to be drawn to foreign names. It might be interesting to do a little price comparison here. Iran's culture and traditions play a big role in consumer trends. For example, newlyweds are expected to move into a home fully furnished with brand new items. The budget needed to furnish a home can cost upwards of $30,000 depending on the decision to purchase foreign brands. However, the budget needed to purchase Iranian brands for ordinary items is far less. One would need a budget of around $10,000 to get it done. For example, the cost of an average two-door Iranian brand refrigerator is roughly $350. The same standard double-door refrigerator made by a Korean brand is roughly $2,500 when purchased in Iran. That is, of course, based on the daily exchange rate of 30,000 tumans to the dollar. In 2018, the government banned the import of foreign brands. Nevertheless, these brands were still seen in the domestic market. This was partly due to existing stockpiles of previous imports. The government implemented the initiative, aiming at strengthening domestic production and sales. But this gave rise to a lucrative black market of smuggled home appliances, which is still being regulated. Trafficked goods have been reduced in recent years. However, they still find their way into the domestic market.
Companies like the one we just mentioned are at the helm of this industry. Currently, there are some 80,000 home appliance manufacturing units in the country. Their domestic productions have not only helped satisfy local needs, but also saved the country millions on imports. Officials say the country is now self-sufficient in terms of the production of these items.
Iran's home appliance manufacturers were operating below their potential capacities around 2018. Before the ban on imports, some 85% of foreign brands available in the country were domestically produced under foreign licenses. The necessary infrastructure existed, but there was little domestic demand due to the competition with foreign brands. Based on figures from the Electrical, Metal and Home Appliance Office of the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, the 2018 import ban was effective. Data from the office shows last year Iran produced over 15 million home appliance units. This is 3 million units more than the government's target of last year and double the production figure of 2018. Officials with the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade say indigenizing home appliance parts has reduced imports by $500 million. Such an increase in production also means that home appliance exports skyrocketed. Last year, $140 million worth of these items were exported, and the government hopes to push this figure to $200 million this year. Some industry participants argue one way to increase quality and expand Iran's home appliance market is by lifting the ban on imports. They say the industry has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years, adding it is capable of growing stronger through serious local and international competition. Others argue that it's too soon to lift the ban as more steps need to be taken to strengthen domestic infrastructure for manufacturing home appliances. Historically, universities were created to satisfy a thirst for knowledge. All over the world, rulers established knowledge academies for society to benefit from scholarly expertise generated in these institutions. And now, universities have an innate discovery. Their professors write leading research, and their scientific breakthroughs have revolutionized industries. Universities have contributed to health and medicine, which has sometimes literally stopped epidemics and saved lives. With this in mind, and universities would make for excellent...
Welcome to another edition of Supports the Development. See why research is so important in the growth of industries. Stay with us as we uncover how the higher education system is contributing to the expansion of the national economy.
To get more insight on how universities support development of technology, we visited one in the capital city, Tehran. Islamic Azad University, Northern Tehran Unit, has been around for decades. Each year, some 40,000 students matriculate in bachelor's, master's, and PhD programs. Academia shares the entrepreneurial drive for discovery and innovation. So, this university adopted a program for the development of technology and engineering, which is called the Roche Center. It is a growth center that manages and operates dozens of academic incubators. The program not only supports student innovation and entrepreneurship, but also provides services to knowledge-based companies for research and development. This platform receives support and oversight from the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology and the National Innovation Fund. The main goal in developing this program is to find technological solutions for various needs of the country. For example, the outcome of a research project conducted here was the formulation of a medicine used to treat COVID-19 infections. There are 40 core projects currently in incubation here, and the center has collaborations in many fields of the industry. It is able to stay present in innovative technology arenas by directly using academic research and potentials of its students.
Now, the advantage of growth programs, such as the one we just mentioned, is that it creates a network between students, research and knowledge-based firms. Most essentially, it joins the puzzle pieces of knowledge, tools and funds together needed for manufacturing innovative products. This helps create new and advanced products that might not exist in the market or need to be further developed for industries.
The center offers important facilities for scientific studies. It houses a large and highly equipped laboratory complex for advanced research. The lab provides services and equipment to 6 departments at the university, such as biochemistry and biology. The lab complex has many functions. One is to provide research facilities to students in master's and PhD programs in various sciences. Here, students who have graduated are also employed to conduct research brought in from outside knowledge-based companies. The other function of the lab is to provide a constructive link between university research and industries. For example, knowledge-based companies that produce pharmaceuticals can conduct their research and development at the highly equipped workshops. Research at this lab has helped companies produce many vital products that were previously imported. It might be interesting to know that researchers here adhere to strict national and international standards for product quality and safety. This is a critical step for startups or knowledge-based companies who want to commercialize products they have developed. This center was developed in response to the US sanctions. It has manufactured several products and advanced technology to satisfy the needs of Iranians during the period of sanctions. Some of these products are widely used in the medical sector.
Each university in the country has a growth program that supports the entrepreneurship and innovation of students and some businesses. These centers transform creativity and scientific research into products available in the market. In a nutshell, academic incubators are one of the tools used for economic growth. So, what is the government doing to strengthen research and expand the knowledge-based economy?
In 2016, Iran had five times more higher education centers than most developed countries in the world. At that time, there were some 2,640 higher education centers combined. By comparison, this number was just 40 units less than China, which is the most populous country in the world. That's all according to the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology. The ministry began implementing a nationwide plan to reorganize and aggregate higher education centers last year. Under this plan, small-scale academic establishments are aggregated into a network and operated under the auspices of major universities. This saves the country millions of dollars, and educational institutions are able to share financial and educational resources. This scheme carries many benefits. First, it helps academic institutions increase the quality of education and expand the reach of academic incubators. And second, it helps the government and higher education centers efficiently allocate funds and resources to develop focused programs for research. R&D funding is also an investment in regional innovation ecosystems that leads to advanced technology production needed in industries. There are around 3.5 million students in Iran, and increasing the number of graduates has an overall positive effect on high-tech employment in the long run.
Universities play an important role in determining a region's capacity for innovation and transforming new ideas into economic activity. They educate the local workforce, which creates human capital and produces intellectual property. Universities also indirectly contribute through their research activities, which other businesses can use to make commercial value. These foundational research activities help create and advance industries in many ways.
For example, the medical sector is one that has greatly benefited from advanced technology developed by universities and research-based firms. 56% of medical equipment available in the world market in 2018 had Iranian versions. That was based on figures from the National Medical Device Directorate. Some of these items were also on the US sanctions list. These products were developed domestically and produced along the lines of international standards, allowing them to compete in markets abroad. Another advantage of indigenizing advanced medical equipment was reducing costs and dependence on imports. Based on the National Medical Device Directorate, Iran currently exports its medical products to 54 countries across the world. In 2018, the domestic market for these items was estimated to be worth nearly $3 billion.
Okay, I believe it's time for me to take a break and pass the show over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field.
Hello, everyone. We are at Inatex International Innovation and Technology Exhibition. Why are we here? Well, this is a perfect place for different businesses and entrepreneurs to promote what they do and their businesses and to find investors. So let's dive in and find out more.
Focusing on science, technology and innovation ecosystems, the International Innovation and Technology Exhibition is the meeting point of businessmen, technologists, industrialists and researchers of different countries, held not only to introduce products and form partnerships, but also to provide various insights on the latest global competitive pricing, quality standards, developments, scientific findings and economic technological ideas. In addition to introducing state-of-the-art technologies to large and medium industries, This event tries to connect customers of technology products with their respective manufacturers and offer investment opportunities to investors of technology and startups.
Among all companies that are active here in this event, we have found one which has done an exemplary activity, and that is supporting smaller local businesses in their province, and that is Rafsanjan Sarchishme Copper Company. Some 400 companies are in this exhibition. Now, in addition to normal products that you can find out everywhere, they have got some sorts of applications. In addition to their exhibition in this innovation park, they also have different events, like different companies and entrepreneurs can present and promote their products in order to show themselves and to attract investors. That's something amazing.
This exhibition has hosted the most significant players in the innovation and technology ecosystem over the years. This stage is not limited to a specific area of technology and innovation, but rather aims to increase the synergy of technology experts and entrepreneurs coming into contact. Therefore, the latest innovation and technology trends are reviewed at this event every year. Things such as metaverse, metadata, Internet of Things, physics, cloud computing, and blockchain.
Okay, I guess that's the end of today's show. Today, for the first time, I visited an exhibition like this, a place for different businesses, companies, and entrepreneurs to see one another and to find a way to cooperate. And that's the specific feature of this event. Thank you.
Many thanks for that awesome report. There is so much more that can be said about the home appliance industry and its related trades. So let's check out some news and trends in this sector. The country is keen to bolster and further develop the home appliance sector. So it has launched a new innovation center that focuses on making products needed in this industry.
Some of the products being developed here include inverter compressors and other integrated products using artificial intelligence and electronics, among others. The center also will use nanoscience knowledge to create a new range of smart and technological products. The goal is to complement the tech ecosystem by providing a space where knowledge-based companies and startups carry out concentrated activities. It is also meant to indigenize products for domestic needs and exports.
Iran's home appliance market is worth roughly $6 billion per year, but industry participants say 40% of this market is dominated by contraband. So, how has the government responded to this issue?
The government has carried out several schemes to combat this problem with heavier regulation. One step was to implement an ID program for all home appliances being sold. Another was the closure of over 300 websites offering smuggled goods. In June 2020, the first phase of the National Anti-Smuggling Plan was implemented. The Association of Industry of Household Appliances says such initiatives have reduced the number of smuggled goods to nearly $900 million. That's in contrast to the year before, when some $2 billion worth of trafficked goods were traded.
Well, that wraps up our program for today. Don't forget to leave us your feedback. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.